This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The Senate just voted. This is sort of like, you know, drip, 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 but it's actually step, step, step. They just voted 60 to, what, 38 or something like that, but they got the 60 votes they needed to break a Democratic filibuster on ending debate about fast track. What this means is that now they can vote on it, and they don't need 60 votes, they only need 50. If Joe Biden might, you know, go against it, they might need 51, but who knows? He's not going to, obviously. You know, the administration wants this. In fact, I wonder if this might have something to do with why Joe Biden isn't running for president, because he knows how badly this is going to stain, this would stain him as a member of the administration. So fast track, trade promotion authority, TPA, they're calling this. They've got to come up with euphemisms, right, to not seriously tell you, honestly tell you what's going on. Fast track is moving ahead. And probably the final vote on it will be tomorrow in the Senate. And odds are, you know, it'll pass, and then, you know, we'll see. I mean, the president has said in the past he would not sign trade promotion authority, fast track, without trade adjustment authority, that is $700 million to help out people who are going to lose their jobs because of this trade, because of the first of the trade deals that this is going to promote, which would be fast track, which would be TPP, excuse me. But whether the president is going to keep that campaign promise or not, or that, I don't know if it was made in a campaign, but I'm very skeptical. And then the Republicans are going to vote on the $700 million to help out those of you who might work in industries that are going to end up vanishing and going to Vietnam. In the Senate, they're going to attach it to a bill to fund Africa. But in the House, they may well pull it out. I mean, there's a lot of opposition to trade promotion trade adjustment authority. I can't keep the acronym. To giving money to working people because they got screwed by a trade deal. There's a lot of opposition to that among Republicans in the House of Representatives. So it may be that the president just gets fast track and he doesn't get $700 million to help out working people. Although even that, I mean, it's a scam, right? Every one of these trade deals since 1962 has had that attached to it, and it's always been a scam. It doesn't really help people. And in fact, you know, to the extent that it's paying for education, it's really a gift to the for-profit colleges and the trade schools. So anyhow, that's going on. The other question that I wanted to raise in this first hour, it's anything goes summer, though. I mean, if there's anything on your mind you want to talk about, feel free. Oh, let me just finish this up with the names of the people who voted. These are the people who, as time goes on, these are the Democrats who I will, in all probability, be aggressively supporting primary challengers to. In the Senate, Michael Bennett of Colorado, Maria Cantwell of Washington State, Thomas Carper of Delaware, Chris Coons of Delaware, Dianne Feinstein of California, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Tim Kaine of Virginia, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, Patty Murray of Washington State, Bill Nelson of Florida, Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, Mark Warner of Virginia, and, of course, Ron Wyden of Oregon. It's amazing. This is the same 13 who voted last time, you know, and I'm guessing a few of them probably won't vote for it tomorrow because their votes aren't going to be needed. I mean, now that they broke the filibuster with these 60 votes, they only need 50 votes, and there's more than 50 Republicans in the Senate. Although Ted Cruz has come out and said he's not going to vote for it. Right. So we'll see. F-L-A-D-E-M, Flatum, maybe, is the diarist over at Daily Kos, asks the question, and I think this is a really important one, and I'd like to ask it of you and get your thoughts. He asks the question, why is racism never condemned as unpatriotic? And he points out that the number three Republican in the House of Representatives, a guy named Steve Scalise, right? He's the House Majority Whip. See, there's John Boehner. Who's number two in the House, Shane? Do you know? It's Kevin McCarthy, isn't it? Yeah, Kevin McCarthy. And then Steve Scalise. Kevin McCarthy, by the way, was part of the group that met in the caucus room conspiracy on January 20th, 2009. So Steve Scalise, when he ran in the, you know, for his seat in the House of Representatives, David Duke, Scalise must be from what, Alabama, Mississippi? Can you look that up for me while I'm gone? Louisiana? Yeah, Louisiana, that would make sense. But whatever it was, David Duke had run in that state and got a real respectable showing. Now, David Duke is a neo-Nazi who says Louisiana. Okay, so Steve Scalise is from Louisiana, too. And David Duke had run and, you know, got a respectable showing back in the day. And David Duke, of course, being a neo-Nazi who believes that, you know, basically mixing races is a terrible thing. We should go back to segregation, blah, 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 blah. And also, you know, his opinion of the, actually, David Duke's opinion of the Jews is even more virulent than his opinion of blacks. Every time, the two or three times I've tried to debate him, and I've given up, you know, it's been a few years now, he would immediately go off on the Jews. All the bankers are Jews, all the, you know, blah, 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 blah. They run the world. They, you know, they're just trying to, you know, make us fight with the blacks and whatever. Right. So Steve Scalise, the number three representative, the third ranking representative in the House, Republican in the House of Representatives, when he was running for office, he said that he basically ran as a David Duke who could get elected. This is a verbatim quote. The novelty of David Duke has worn off. The voters in this district are smart enough to realize that they need to get behind someone who not only believes in the issues they care about, that would be the issues that David Duke cares about, but also can get elected. Duke has proven that he can't get elected, and that's the first and most important thing. So Flodem then says, let's try a thought experiment. What if he, instead of saying David Duke, he had said ISIS or communism? Why is it that in the United States of America, inside the Republican Party, nakedly pandering to racists, the so-called Confederate flag, it's not even the Confederate flag. I learned this from James Clyburn last night on, I think, Chris Hayes' show. The good citizens of South Carolina did not fight under the stars and bars. That was Robert Lee's flag for the Northern Virginia militia. The South Carolinians fought under a completely different flag. That flag only went up over South Carolina in 1962 in response to forced busing as a consequence of Brown v. Board and all the conversations that were happening about the possibility of a Voting Rights Act and a Civil Rights Act. So the Robert E. Lee's flag was put up over the, you know, and stitched into the flag of Mississippi in the 60s as a way of saying, no, we're opposed to integration. But anyway, why is this considered patriotic?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Why is Steve Scalise, you know, running as, hey, I'm a David Duke who's electable. Why would anybody consider that patriotic? And welcome back, Dan in Santa Paula, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Well, I wanted to talk about South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
In that we had nine people murdered But one of them was a sitting senator.
Right, who was assassinated.
So shouldn't he be charged under some sort of assassination law?
Yes, I agree.
And, like, you know, and if a sitting state official, isn't this an act of treason?
You know, I don't know the law on this, but morally, I would say certainly. It was an attempt to, I would say probably the word that's most accurate is terrorism, because this was an attempt using violence and making sure that the message associated with that violence got out to the people. In other words, he left one woman alive so that she could tell everybody else what he said. And what he said was that he had to do this because black people were raping white women and were taking over America, which, frankly, in my mind, is a reference to President Obama as well as black elected officials. And when he came into the church,
totally
he specifically
agree.
Asked who was the state senator. And that was, one of the people he murdered. So I think this, I think that, we should call him a terrorist. And he should be.
In addition, if he's a terrorist, should we not label the NRA a terrorist organization, or at least an organization that advocates terrorism?
Or an organization that supports, it's like you don't have to be a terrorist organization relative to ISIL or something like that. If you simply promote their ideas, or if you give them a forum, or if you put up a website for them or anything, you're guilty of a crime of helping promote terrorism. And in my opinion, the National Rifle Association has gone from being, and I was an NRA member back in the day. It used to be a relatively small organization of gun owners that did gun safety classes, things like that. They have gone from that to being just pretty much nakedly shills for a multi-billion-dollar weapons industry. And
I totally agree. I was a member of the NRA back when I was a kid, but yeah. I'm 74 years old. And I'm just not understanding the direction that the country's going.
Yeah. Well, in the next hour, Neil McCabe is going to drop by, and I'm going to be asking him, is Wayne LaPierre going to burn in hell? Because the Pope has come out and said that you can't be a good Christian. You can't be a Christian and be a gun manufacturer or even an investor in gun manufacturing.
Well, so, we talk about gun violence all the time. Shouldn't we be talking about gun deaths, not just incidents of violence one against another, but the accidental deaths that happen?
Yeah. The probably the most underreported stories in America are the children every day who are dying as a result of guns and by accident, and the suicides that happen because of guns, because of the easy availability of guns. That maybe actually there's a fair amount of evidence that suicide rates go down when gun control goes up. The fewer guns are available, the less frequently people commit suicide. Because it's easy and instant. And we have serious problems here, Dan. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour now. TPP isn't the only trade deal that's going to get shoved through Congress as a result of Fast Track probably passing the Senate tomorrow. And now it's going to be up to Republicans. I mean, this Mark Levin is going to have to rally his base, right? Assuming that he's still taking this position that Fast Track is unconstitutional. It's going to be up to Republican senators. And if you're represented by a Republican senator, feel free to call them, 202-225-3121, and say no to Fast Track. But I think that this thing is, I think this cake is baked. But in the UK, there's another agreement. The TPP is the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA. Then there's another one called TTIP, which is trade something, 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 and it has to do with Europe. And the doctors in the UK are quite flipped out about this because they're concerned that it's going to destroy the National Health Service of England or of the United Kingdom. So Captain Obvious pointing over at, this is from the Telegraph, posting over at DU. Doctors have voted overwhelmingly to urge the government to remove health and social care services from a controversial trade agreement between the EU and the United States. If there's anything resembling an NHS by the time this treaty is negotiated, it won't survive, one general practitioner warned. This is extraordinary. He says, if there's anything resembling the NHS, it won't survive. The correct motion is to kill this treaty dead, not to tolerate it sneaking in and mugging us. So the Europeans are starting to push back, too. But back to why is racism never condemned as anti-patriotic? Lindsey Graham is running for president, a Republican from South Carolina. Thank you. By the way, after Dylan Storm Roof, and I think, you know, Storm is an important part of his name. I suspect that it's a very important part of his name. After he killed 9 people, 12 hours later, this is not The Onion, right? This is from thesource.com. Just 12 hours later on Thursday morning, Roof was captured while on the run in North Carolina after authorities pulled over a Hyundai sedan where the murderous youth had apparently piloted out of town. He's not a youth. He's a 21-year-old man. The FBI quickly stepped in and handled Roof's questioning after his swift arrest. But prior to that, during transport, his handling by the police was particularly peculiar. According to the account Shelby Police Chief Jeff Ledford gave to the Charlotte Observer, Roof complained of hunger, so they took him to Burger King and fed him. He was treated to a meal at Burger King. Earlier in the day, he'd bought water and chips at a South Charlotte police station, but now he was hungry, so they brought him food from a nearby Burger King. After slaughtering 9 people in a church, he was arrested. He was strapped with a protective bulletproof vest and then treated to burgers and fries. Does anybody remember how the police handled Freddie Gray? Right, sticking him in the truck, you know, with his hands shackled behind him and his ankles shackled, and then gave him Philadelphia Rough Ride, Pittsburgh Rough Ride, Baltimore Rough Ride, that's right. If Dylan Roof had been black. Which takes me back to the patriotism of racism in the Republican Party. Lindsey Graham, one of his closest advisors is a guy named Richard Quinn, writes Flaydam over at Kos, Daily Kos. He, for many years, edited a magazine called Southern Partisan. In his capacity as editor, that Quinn wrote that Martin Luther King, I'm quoting now from Flaydam's post over at Daily Kos, wrote that Martin Luther King Jr.'s role in the civil rights movement was, quote, to lead his people into a perpetual dependence on the welfare state, a terrible bondage of body and soul, end quote. He called Nelson Mandela a terrorist and a bad egg. And about David Duke's election, he wrote, what better way to reject politics as usual than to elect a maverick like David Duke? And in one column, he called Martin Luther King's day's purpose vitriolic and profane. Now, this is you know, one of Lindsey Graham's closest advisors. So you've got the number 3 Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives who works closely with Kevin McCarthy and John Boehner. It's the 3 of them. They basically run the House. Running on a platform in Louisiana that was basically, I'm with David Duke, but he's not electable because he's viewed as a crackpot, so elect me. That's Steve Scalise. And then you've got Mr. Quinn, Richard Quinn, who's the advisor to Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina. And nobody is saying that their racism is unpatriotic. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, nobody's saying anybody's racism is unpatriotic. Isn't racism unpatriotic? I mean, I realize that this country was based on racism. It was based on a genocide of Native Americans. It was based on a Holocaust for African Americans. Concentration camps all across the South called plantations. I get that. But why are these people not called something beyond just bigots? Like, bigots is such a soft word, right? Even racists has become a soft word. In the Republican Party, being called a racist, it'll actually get you elected. Why are we not calling this unpatriotic? In fact, why are we not calling this traitorous? The Stars and Bars was the flag of Robert E. Lee of the Northern Virginia Army. It was not the flag of the Confederacy in South Carolina or in Georgia or in Alabama or in Louisiana, where it's on the flag of the state. It was just the flag under which Robert E. Lee fought. And it was only put up in 1962 to protest busing and integration and Brown v. Board and the possibility of a Voting Rights Act and a Civil Rights Act.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Why are these Republicans who weasel around, dance around their own racism, and then get themselves elected on it like Ronald Reagan did, why are they not called out as being traitors, essentially? Bad and the very, very amundly ugly, the good. Black Lives Matter protesters. A Black Lives Matter protester turned a monument to American traitors into a protest over the weekend. The permanent inscription on the statue reads, "To the Confederate Defenders of Charleston," and has the years of the Civil War. But a protester spray-painted the statue with Black Lives Matter. Police are investigating the matter, but the real question is, who did this? Is not who did this. The real question is, why is there a monument celebrating an army of traitors and a history of racism? The bad. Mike Huckabee, the Republican presidential hopeful, called on Christians to carry out civil disobedience if the Supreme Court rules in favor of gay marriage. In a really bizarre twist, the former governor of Arkansas compared marriage equality to the Supreme Court's ruling in Dred Scott. Seriously, take a look.
And for many of us, civil disobedience, when we believe that the civil government has acted outside of nature and nature's God, outside of the bounds of the law, outside of the bounds of the Constitution, we believe that it's the right and moral thing to do. Now, yes, I understand that's a very controversial thing to say. But, Todd, what if no one had acted in disobedience to the Dred Scott decision of 1857? What if the entire country had capitulated to judicial tyranny? And we just said that because the Supreme Court in 1857 said that a black person wasn't fully human, suppose we had accepted that. Suppose Abraham Lincoln, our president, had accepted that. Would that have been the right course of action? And I don't know of anyone. I mean, seriously, I personally don't know of anyone who believes that the Supreme Court made the right decision in Dred Scott.
If the court rules in favor of marriage equality and Christians ignore it, it won't be like protesting discrimination after Dred Scott, Mr. Huckabee. It will be like people protesting integration after Brown v. Board of Education. You know, the racists who are out there saying, how dare they? And the very, very ugly, Anthony Farah. The Texas oil executive is facing assault charges after getting out of his car and punching a man unconscious. The victim, Andy Smith, was walking in Austin with his husband when Farah allegedly drove by and nearly hit the couple with his car. According to the police report, Smith yelled, "You nearly hit us," at which point Farah replied with a homophobic expletive, got out of his car, punched Smith in the head, and then drove away. In other words, Farah managed to combine road rage with violent homophobia. And that is very, very ugly. Bernie just sent an email out to his list. I'm on his list, so I got it. He says, "When my Republican colleagues talk about family values, what they usually mean is opposition to a woman's right to choose, opposition to contraception, opposition to gay rights, and support for abstinence-only education." He said, "Let me give a somewhat different perspective on family values. When a mother has a baby and is unable to spend time with that child during the first weeks and months of his or her life, that is not a family value. When a wife is diagnosed with cancer and a husband can't take time off work to take care of her, that is not a family value. When a mother is forced to send her sick child to school because she can't afford to stay home with her, that is not a family value. When a husband, wife, and kids during the course of an entire year are unable to spend any time together on vacation, that is not a family value. The Republican agenda, this is Bernie Sanders channeling Harry Truman. Finally, somebody running as a Democrat for president of the United States channeling Harry Truman. Bernie Sanders says the Republican agenda for families is really an attack on everything that a family is supposed to stand for. I'm running for president because I will stand for real family values. Go get them, Bernie. Okay, Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today? Charles, can you hear me? Charles, try calling right back. See if it works. He's on line 10. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
All right. Can you hear me?
I do.
Great. Anyway, that flag went up on the State House in South Carolina in 1961, but, you know, what's a year? But it was Strom Thurmond that ran it up.
Right. As governor, right?
The same one. As governor. The same one that, I can't remember the exact year he left the Democratic Party and formed the Dixiecrats and eventually became a Republican.
Right. It was
the issue of voting rights. And
yeah. Strom Thurmond was a naked racist. He was that got you elected governor of South Carolina in the 1950s and 1960s was being opposed.
Back then they didn't,
go ahead.
You know, back then they didn't let black people vote, at least not in any numbers.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, that flag, like you were saying, the flag of treason. You know, how else do you define taking up arms against your duly elected government other than treason?
Yeah, it is literally the definition of treason. And in fact, I mean, lest we forget, Robert E. Lee, 6 months after the Civil War was over, applied for citizenship in the United States. Right. He had renounced his U.S. citizenship.
He had to retake a loyalty oath.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. It's amazing. Chris, thanks for the call. Robert in Bullhead City, Arizona. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, we're talking about TPP, and my interest is, why did President Obama spend so much time in Arab countries, more than any president in history? And now he's looking at Israel as basically a nation that does not give people a fair chance. But the thing is...
Well, hang on just a second here. First of all, how many Jewish states are there in the world?
Excuse me?
How many Muslim states are there in the world, officially Muslim states? Do you know?
Oh, no, sir.
Is it more than one?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, how many Jewish states are there in the world?
One.
Okay, great. President Obama has repeatedly said that he is a supporter of Israel, that we are strong advocates of Israel. He disagrees with Netanyahu on a couple of things. Number one, Netanyahu really wants to have a war with Iran. President Obama doesn't. And number two, Netanyahu is opposed to a two-state solution. He said if he was elected prime minister, it would not happen on his watch. And President Obama is an advocate of a two-state solution. That is not dissing Israel. That is disagreeing about politics with Netanyahu. And I disagree with Netanyahu on that, and a lot of Americans do. And a lot of American Jews do. I'm not Jewish, but, you know, a lot do, number one. Number two, he visited a number of Arab states because there's incredible turmoil in these Arab states. The Arab Spring is happening. He went to Israel. He went to Egypt. I don't know. What other country did he go to besides Egypt? Robert?
He went to, I believe it was 8 different countries.
What countries are they? I remember when he went to Egypt. Maybe he visited Qatar or something like that. We've got our largest military base in the region there.
He went to Saudi Arabia. He went to Syria, actually, believe it or not. And there was a few other countries.
Yeah.
My point.
Well, this is a very important part. You know, my question is, why didn't he go to the West Bank? Right. Why didn't he go to Gaza? You know, I think.
Hear me out on this one, please.
Okay.
This is my point. Arabs, Palestinians, or Arabs do not belong in Israel. It's that plain and simple. They don't have the right to be there.
Because the United Nations decided that in
1948. Let's not forget Arafat, the PLO, the Hamas, all that they've done. Israel is supposed to be a sovereign nation. Now, why is...
So why are they running a prison state in Gaza?
Yeah, why?
Well, that's a question that, you know, I think a lot of people are asking. You know, why is Israel essentially an apartheid state right now, you know, with relative to Gaza and the West Bank? And why are they supporting
her, sir? All right, let's put it this way. Why don't we have China have part of our country and Russia another part of our country? And then we all, you know.
No, if you want to make that analogy, Robert, the question should be the Native Americans were here first, and then we took the country from them. Should we give it back to them?
Absolutely not. And why should?
Okay, so and then the Jews came in after 1948, and actually there were always Jews in that part of the world. This is an area that has historically been both Palestinian and Jewish, and that's what makes this so mixed up. I mean, they're both Semitic people, and this is a real challenge. I'm a supporter of Israel, and I'm a supporter of a Palestinian state. You can be both.
I'm not against the Arabs. Don't get me wrong here. No,
come on, Robert. This sounds like, you know, one of my best friends is black kind of thing.
Oh, well, you know, that's all good. You know, we could say that, but truly I'm not, if you knew me personally. My point being is that the Arabs have pushed Israel all the way to the Mediterranean Sea throughout history. Now, that cannot be disagreed.
The history of that region is insanely complex, and you can't reduce it to a single sentence like that, Robert. You just can't. I'm sorry. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, what the heck? It's Anything Goes Summer. So we'll be back. Welcome back. Drew, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Olathe, Kansas. Hey, Drew, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to talk about how China will basically manipulate history to appear as if they have a legitimate claim to certain countries. We know that Tibet is one where it's obviously questionable, but they also have another territory called Jilin, which I don't know if you know, but Korea used to be much bigger than it currently is.
Mm. I didn't know that.
Up to the current dynasty, before the Qing dynasty, they had pretty much that whole swath. But where I'm going here is basically I had a teacher in one of my classes who pointed me to an article where North Koreans are going out of their, you know, North Korea, and they're digging up stuff in archaeology. And as part of unearthing these remains, they have to sign an agreement which confers the legitimacy of this history to China, therefore also conferring, you know, sovereign status and legitimacy of places like Jilin to China. And I just wanted to put this out there for people to kind of warn them that China is even more dangerous in certain aspects and smarter than we realize, at least the Chinese government.
China is doing what I would say the United States should be doing, which is they're putting themselves first. China's trade policy is China first. China's military policy is China first. The two properties that you talked to, you know, I'm unfamiliar with this Jilin, but I do obviously know about the Dalai Lama's hometown, shall we say. But next they're going to go after Taiwan. Mark my words. And they're gonna lock down Hong Kong, which has been a kind of special district, and now the Hong Kong people are saying, we want to vote for our own people, and the Chinese government is saying, no, can't do that. Mm-hmm. And what they're demonstrating, by the way, what China has very, very successfully demonstrated, is that state-run capitalism will beat private profit motive capitalism. They are eating our lunch, and they're doing it because state-run capitalism. This is the essence. I mean, this is what Henry Wallace warned about in the United States in 1944. When he wrote that op-ed in the New York Times, was that the industrialists, holding economic power, would be reaching out for the power of government, so that combining the two, they could, his phrase was keep the working man in eternal subjection. But it also makes it much, makes business much more successful when they've got the power of the state. And we're seeing that happening fairly rapidly in the United States, as businesses now, our Supreme Court has made it legal for businesses to buy politicians. And so, businesses acquiring more and more political power in the United States. We're coming to look more like China than China is coming to look like us. That's a scary thing.
And China is even greener than us. I did a report comparing China and Germany, and they were pretty much neck and neck.
Yeah, in terms of installation of wind and solar. On the other hand, they're also building a coal-fired power plant mm-hmm. about every other week in China. So, it's a mixed bag. But, I mean, they're industrializing really rapidly. They've got a 7% annual GDP growth. We're lucky to have 2%. They just looked at us and they said, okay, we're going to do what they did before Reagan, and we'll let America shoot themselves in the foot with Reaganism, which is exactly what happened. Drew, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. Taking back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's up? Alan? Alan's on line nine, which is the other half of line 10. I'm thinking maybe we've got a bad box. You can check him out. Victor in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Victor, what's up? Victor, can you hear me?
Oh, I'm here, Tom. I heard you say Alan, then it just cut off. Okay. What I have to talk about is more or less the other racism that's going on in America, other than the mass shootings, like how they have disenfranchised us with the judicial system. Like right now, I'm in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. I have a problem. Like I had to file a PFA on my son's mother, which is a white woman, okay? And when I did that, only reason why I did that, because she assaulted me, bust out the windows in the house when it was, in like November, it was very cold outside. And the police told me, well, you got to get a PFA on her so that
what's a PSA?
Usually do this.
Is that a restraining order?
PSA, a protection order of abuse.
Okay.
So I filed one on her so that I could stop her from, doing stuff to me. She turned around 3 weeks later, and when mine was getting finalized, and filed one on me.
Oh.
And they had already arrested her for harassment, because when they came, my face was bloody from her scratching me up. All like three windows in the house was busted out.
Wow. So you were married to a violent white woman, and you're a black guy. Do I have that right?
Something like that. I wasn't ever married to her. I just had a child with her.
Okay, you had a child with her. Close enough.
Yeah. And when I went to go finalize this issue with the judge, he didn't want to hear my side of the story, because I had the only proof, because she put it in the PFA. I was real abusive to her and all this and that.
Right.
And my whole case was, okay, if I was abusive to you, then why when the police came, I was all beat up and nothing was wrong with you.
Right.
That was my whole case.
But the judge looked at you and he said, hey, there's a black guy, there's a white woman, it must be the black guy's fault, right?
Yeah. So he put the PSA on both of us.
Wow.
And since then, she has used that PSA to further harass me. I've been locked up twice. One time, she said that I drove past her and gave her the middle finger. I was actually in the town over in the courthouse because my son got abused by her and her boyfriend. And I was, because I had him on a PFA with me, but the judge took him off.
Right. So you weren't even there, and she alleged that you flipped her the bird, and for that you got arrested?
I got arrested and did 4 months for it.
4 months in jail?
Yes, 4 months in jail, and I had to pay $1,500.
Wow.
That I haven't paid yet.
Amazing. Amazing.
And then when I came home, I was home for like a month, and she called the police and said, she called me, and I had the proof on my phone that she called me, and I didn't answer my phone because I knew her number. She went to the police station and told the police that I called her.
Huh.
And with that, again, another 6 months.
Another 6 months in jail. That's amazing. You know, assuming that everything that you're saying is true, Victor, and I have no reason to believe it's not, this is just a classic example of white privilege in the United States.
But, yeah, that's true. And then the kick is, Tom, okay, she tried to hit me with her car twice in the last in this month alone.
Yeah.
I went to the police. They did nothing about it.
Wow. Wow.
And I called my mayor. I wrote to the mayor here, which his name is Bruce Hickersmith.
Yeah.
He gave me the long song and dance talking about nobody wins if we arrest her. I'm
right.
Like, I'm not looking for somebody. I'm not looking to win. I'm looking for accountability.
Yeah. Well, and presumably you're looking not to get beat up again, too. That's amazing. That's amazing. Victor, thanks for calling and sharing the story with us. It's just, you know, they kind of stack up, you know, these. It's amazing. Victor, thank you. Reggie in Salem, Arkansas. Hey, Reggie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, listen, I need to tell you one thing first. I'm white. I have two grandchildren that are biracial that I love more than life. And I'm watching all this stuff going on in Charleston, and I'm watching all these people running to change the Confederate flag and all this stuff. And that's fine, well, and good. But
yeah.
Is this just a false flag, because none of those people want to talk about gun control?
All right.
It's like this is all you hear. You don't hear anything about the fact that this kid had a arrest record and still got a gun.
Yeah. Well, actually, his dad apparently bought the gun and gave it to him illegally.
See, now,
I've heard both.
His dad bought it, and I've heard that he bought it. So,
yeah.
I don't know, but I'm wondering, you know, if all these Republicans that got money from this conservative group are running to pay it back or give it
to Charles. Here's what's going on, Reggie. They're going to continue their racist policies. They're going to continue their dog whistle politics. In fact, they're probably going to put it on steroids. And the way they do that, using the old Lee Atwater thing, is, you know, they're going to try and, you know, gut social welfare programs because it helps those people, right? And on and on and on. But now with the flag, Robert E. Lee's battle flag. Nikki Haley and a lot of these other, you know, Southern Republicans who basically got elected appealing to the white racist vote are going to be able to say, see, I'm not a white racist. Look at what I did. It's a small symbolic act. Yeah, it's a small victory, I think, for people who are opposed to racism. It's an indication of the power of public pressure, because that's what they're bowing to. But I do not expect them to change their ways. I don't think any of these people have had like an epiphany or a conversion. I think if they had, they would leave the Republican Party tomorrow. The Republican Party, ever since Nixon, has been the party calling out to racists. It's how Ronald Reagan ran his campaign and ran the White House. I think this is just cosmetic. Reggie, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the Pope has come out and said, you know, you can't be a Christian and be a gun manufacturer or investor. It's very interesting. In the United States, 1 in 3 people know someone who's been shot. On average, 31 Americans are murdered with guns every day. 151 are treated for a gun assault in an emergency room every day. On average, every day in the United States, 55 people kill themselves with a firearm. 46 are shot or killed by accident. More than half of them children. The U.S. homicide firearm homicide rate is 20 times higher than the combined rates of 22 countries that equal our wealth and population. 20 times higher. A gun in a home makes it 22 times more likely that it will be used to kill or injure in a domestic homicide, suicide, or unintentional shooting. 2,200% more likely than that it will be used in self-defense. An average of 7 children and teens under the age of 20 are killed by guns every day. American children die by guns 11 times. That's 1,100% more frequently than children in other high-income countries. I could go on and on, but, you know, this, and then we get this, you know, follow the money with the NRA. As an NRA leader, this by Sarah Jones over at Politicus USA, after an NRA leader predictably blamed the Charleston victims for their own death, you know, tone deaf, ignorant, whatever. The NRA is a virtual subsidiary of the gun industry, according to Business Insider. Business Insider said since 2005, the gun industry and its corporate allies have given between $20 and $52 million to the NRA through their Ring of Freedom sponsor program. Donors include firearm companies like Midway USA, Springfield Armory, Inc., Pierce Bullet Seal Target Systems, and Beretta USA Corporations. Other supporters of the gun industry include Cablas, Storm Ruger & Company, and Smith & Wesson. The NRA also made $20.9 million, about 10% of its revenue, from selling advertising to industry companies marketing products in its many publications in 2010, according to IRS Form 990. Additionally, some companies donate portions of their sales directly to the NRA. Crimson Trace, which makes laser sights, donates 10%. Taurus gives an NRA membership to everyone who buys one of their guns. Storm Ruger gives $1 to the NRA for every gun sold, which amounts to millions. The NRA's revenues are intrinsically linked to the success of the gun business. End of quote from Business Insider. And now the Pope comes along and says, you can't be a Christian if you're involved in this business. So, Neil McCabe, political director of Gravis Insights, Florida-based pollster and columnist at townhall.com, gravisinsights.com, the website. Neil, is Wayne LaPierre going to burn in hell? It sure looks like it to me. He's Catholic. The Pope just basically disowned him.
I'm really troubled and kind of hurt because I don't believe the Holy Father fully comprehends the weight of his words in the United States. And it can't be.
I think he's fully aware of it. And God bless him.
How
can you be a Christian and manufacture weapons of death? Would Jesus do that? Would he encourage his disciples to do that?
Well, you know.
Serious question.
Pope John Paul II.
No, serious question.
Said that there was a right to self-defense, to defend yourself and to defend people that you love. And he said that you have that right to make that decision.
Well, of course, everybody has the right to self-defense. Does that mean that everybody has the right to manufacture, to sell, to promote weapons of mass destruction and weapons of death?
Well, I mean, it's death to you and it's safety to me. I mean, it's like, my sword is okay? So if I run around with a big axe like one of the Swiss guards, I'm okay? I mean, I knew pretty well one of the Swiss guards who for many years was a bodyguard for Pope John Paul I. He's surrounded by 3 plainclothesmen who are members of the Swiss guards who are unarmed, and their only job is to take a bullet for the Holy Father.
Right.
However, everywhere he goes, he's surrounded by 20 machine guns.
Yeah, he's the Pope.
And so does he wonder where these machine guns came from? Were they found in a wine jar in the temple? Did they descend from the clouds? I mean, somebody had to make these guns that are protecting the Holy
somebody
Father.
Somebody who he doesn't consider a good Christian. You got a problem with that?
And that, well, it seems like it hasn't been.
I mean, he drives around a Pope mobile. It's powered by fossil fuels, and he's
right.
And he's condemning the fossil fuel industry too. You know, there are times when you have to compromise, but that doesn't, you know, you haven't answered my question. You know, what would Jesus say to his disciples? Should they go into the gun industry or not? And should they shill for the gun industry the way that the NRA does?
I think that
number two, you haven't answered my question. Do you think Wayne LaPierre is going to burn in hell for what he has done, which has promoted so many deaths in this country?
Oh, listen, Wayne LaPierre is not going to hell, if only for the suffering that has been inflicted upon him by the left.
You mean the millions of dollars a year in income he's taking?
I'm talking about the emotional damage he's had.
My heart is breaking, Neil. My heart is breaking.
Listen, he's not going to listen. We're not going to condemn
him. This guy is a liar and a fraud.
All right, let's talk about our Savior. Our Savior told us to love one another, and our Savior certainly understood that we have an obligation to protect those who can't protect themselves. And so I would,
but not by weapons. Look at what Jesus did and said when Peter pulled his sword just before they took him off to crucify him and cut off the ear of one of the Roman centurions. What did Jesus say?
He who lives by the sword dies by the sword.
And put away your weapon.
And he healed away that. But at the same time, there was another agenda going on. There was another cosmic strip that Peter was interfering with. I believe it was necessary for our Lord not to be rescued, but actually our Lord needed to go to that cross. So Peter was sort of interfering with the prime directive there.
I don't disagree, but still Jesus used it as a teaching moment, assuming that all those things are accurate.
A teaching moment, but I don't think that our Lord would have a problem with a father defending his family from intruders.
I don't
unless,
either.
Unless you, your reading of the scripture says
that I am not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that the Pope is right, that you can't be a good Christian and be promoting profiting from guns.
It's very disturbing. It's very, very disturbing. And I haven't had the opportunity to go to some people that I trust to talk about how that was translated into English. In the past, some of the things that the Holy Father has said has been given a very generous translation to play up to one faction or another, but in the main, I am very troubled that the Pope is sort of wandering into this.
You know, another 3-year-old yesterday found a gun in his under the couch that his father had, a loaded gun, and killed his friend. Actually, this was a 5-year-old, and I mean this happens a half a dozen times a day in the United States. And the people who are promoting these weapons, which are 22 times more likely to end, if they're in a home, it's 22 times more likely to end up the way I just described than somebody trying to defend themselves.
Tom,
they're complicit in those deaths.
Unfortunately, tragedy with the 3-year-old.
This was not unfortunate.
Horrible,
it was predictable.
But it is unfortunate.
It was predictable. 2,200% probability.
These tragedies also, in the end, save thousands of other lives as people refocus on safety and they realize the tragedy and they learn from it.
So we kill 100,000 people, we save 1,000, and the gun industry makes a profit, and that's a good thing?
It's like what happens when you find out somebody didn't wear their seatbelt and they were killed in an accident, you're more likely to wear your seatbelt afterwards.
Seatbelts don't kill people, man.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil McCabe, sorry to dump the last word on you there.
I understand.
GravisInsights.com. Neil McCabe, thanks for dropping by, Neil. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, how you doing?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, Tom. Jill Stein, the Green Party, she's running for president again.
Good.
And she support nationalizing the Federal Reserve and public banking.
Yep.
Well, we talk about that, but do you think people really understand what it really means if we could control our money?
I doubt most Americans have any idea what it means, Jesse. I think that you are exceptionally well educated in this topic, and you're the exception rather than the rule for all Americans.
Well, I don't think so. I think everybody can understand it basically. What it would mean if we could cut a 30-year mortgage to basically 10 years if we control the money, would we want to charge ourselves the front end of 20 years of interest?
Right.
I don't think so.
Well, so this is one of the things that concerns me about this fast track thing, is that the fast track bill will allow Congress to push through this TPIS agreement. It's not, and it may be part of the TPP too, but we know that it's part of TPIS because it's been leaked, which will make it illegal for individual states in the United States to run state-owned banks like North Dakota does. No more public banking. Everything has to be done for a buck by professional privateers, by banksters.
Well, Tom, you know where there's a will, there's a way. I asked you many years ago, would you want to start a public bank? You said, no, I'm no good at money. Louise handled the money.
Yeah.
Well, I make you think back to when the aristocrats used to think people was too stupid to run the democracy. Would you want to give up your vote in a public bank or Federal Reserve to Wall Street versus your knowledge of economics? I don't think so.
No.
So
no, but and this is why I'm a big advocate of credit unions as well, because they're democratic institutions.
Right. Well, what the basic principle is, the people run the show.
Right.
And if we're going to have Greece, us get out of the jam we are, whereas we owe, well, we fractionalizing, I'm saying that word wrong, the earth instead of fractionalizing money, and we know we only got one earth, so we know capitalism don't work.
Right.
So if we're going to use money printed by us and base it off Mother Earth, that's the way we got to go. There's no argument about it.
You're talking about the gold standard?
Yeah, because that's irrelevant. You know, money is a state of mind. We can't think that way no more.
Money is something that in theory reflects human labor. I mean, that was the whole point, that money would be a medium of exchange.
One earth. If we're going to try to dream up what gold, what we want it to be worth, diamonds, oil, name it, we're not living in reality.
Yeah. Jesse, science fiction writer Jack Vance, one of my favorite science fiction writers, wrote a whole series of novels that take place on other planets and galaxies and whatnot. But in all of them, all across the Gaian Reach, the money that everybody uses is called the SVU, single value unit. And it represents, one SVU represents 1 hour of labor by one human being anywhere. So the value of labor was equalized across the universe, and the value of money was based on the value of labor. That, to me, actually seems, instead of basing the value of money on gold, that to me actually seems like a much more commonsensical thing to do. And just say, okay, $1 equals 1 hour of labor, and let's let everything else conform itself to that. Jesse, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back as I'm chugging down my beet juice. Good stuff. Okay. What could I say? Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today? Alan? It's line 9. Yeah. Okay. Albert in Los Angeles. Hey, Albert, can you hear me? Albert can't hear me either. Okay, let's try John in Minneapolis. John, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
And you're on line 10. This is weird. Anyway, back to you, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think perhaps corporate America or the powers that be find racist, hateful people useful, because I think the things that they do, and they relate to it, because I think that the things that they do are rather hateful and not very nice either. And so you have this army of people that you can, you know, use your goons in case things get rough and people get too lippy and the Occupy movement gets too big. You can, you know, unleash the hounds on the rest of us.
Right, right.
And then also, you know, I wanted to say about this shooter, you know, James Gilligan wrote a book. He was a psychiatrist, and he wrote a book on called Violence in America, I think it was called. And one of the things that he said, which I think is kind of interesting, you know, this shooter expressed the idea that he had to do this. And I think that he had to do it to kind of build up his lack of self-esteem. You know, he was a kind of a loner, somewhat of a loser. And I think that joining a racist group often, you know, our people can build up their ego, not in a healthy way.
No, John, you are so right about that. And let me add to that. I think it's the same thing with the guns. You know, we created this thing called the Small Penis Gun Club, and I think that men who are insecure about their sexuality are the ones who are most obsessed with guns. And I think that men who are insecure about their ability to be providers for their family, and, you know, which is increasing across the United States as Reaganomics destroys the middle class, they're the ones who are most likely to become pretty fanatic about racism.
Yeah, and I think they do this, it's to save face, and they were willing to die, you know, for it too, because, you know, they feel like they have nothing to live for, that they've been so, I'm looking for the word, their egos are so destroyed because we do live in a very competitive society. And, these people are kind of marginalized, I think, often and left out, you know, this is what they turn to, which is violence.
I'm with you. John, thank you for the call. Well said. Albert in Los Angeles. Hey, Albert, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Just fine, yeah.
Oh, okay, perfect. I'd just like to have a quick conversation about, you know, diversity. You know, I'm a black male, young 30s. Coming up in the 90s, the biggest thing that, you know, the biggest buzzword we heard was diversity, multiculturalism, and things of that nature.
Right.
And that's kind of gone away. And, you know, social media is just pounding, you know, with racist this, racist that. And, you know, I'm getting backlash from some of my white friends who are saying, hey, you know, you're always talking about race as of late. And I brought up one quick example to them. I said, okay, Google Adam and Eve. And then I went through the whole scientific reason. You know, the only reason why there's difference in skin tone is really basically genes, X's and Y chromosomes, and people can have different skin tones. So we're really all the same race. But my point is, why was every single picture that they Googled of a white person? And right. I think we need to have a
discussion. And Adam and Eve if we wanted to literally say Adam and Eve were the first humans, then they were Tanzanians or Kenyans.
Exactly, and they had to have been of dark skin, because you can just genetically you can't having light skin is just a recessive.
Well, it was the climate. I mean, it's the difference between you and me is the melanin in our skin. That's it. And, you know, your skin is more accommodating to intense sunlight, and mine is more accommodating to long winters with very little sunlight. I make vitamin D more easily than you do, and you get skin cancer less easily than I do. It has to do with a single chemical in our skin, and that's the only difference.
Right, that's the only difference. And my point was, why does every single picture have to be of a white person, knowing that the chances of that is not true? And that's not to demean anybody. It's just because we feel comfortable looking at images of ourselves.
Do you mean that as a literal question or a rhetorical question? Because, you know, I mean, if you mean it literally, I'd say it's because, you know, the power structure in America is white. The textbooks are written by white people. The TV networks are all run by white people.
So that's my point. And back to this white privilege, I don't think we should be using white privilege, because certain white people can't understand that it's not necessarily privilege. We live in a democracy, which is majority rules, and just what you just said, it's not, I don't want to say it's not a privilege, but, you know, white people receive benefits because they're the majority race in the country.
But Albert, your white friends who say to you, why are you talking about race all the time? Have you ever tried saying to them, hey, that's the number one benefit of white privilege, is that you don't have to wonder how your race is going to impact the quality of your day?
I tried, but the way to solve it is to just have more different people,
more diversity,
and things that we see.
Yeah, I'm with you. Albert, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back after the news at the bottom of the hour. It's Anything Goes Summer, and, boy, the Senate. Tomorrow, the final vote on Fast Track. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Sons of Confederate Veterans are mobilizing. A big mass email just went out to all our members. There's apparently 20-some-odd thousand members of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. To become a member, you have to prove that you're, first of all, you have to be a man. And I'm assuming that there's probably also a daughters of American veterans, or of the Confederate veterans, excuse me. And you have to prove that you have an ancestor who fought in the Civil War on the side of the Confederacy. And they're very upset about Nikki Haley pushing the legislature in South Carolina to take down Robert E. Lee's flag, and I find it very, very strange. I'm a member of Sons of the American Revolution. Just happened this year, actually. My mom, when I was a kid, started getting into genealogy, and because her family had been in North America since the 1600s, mostly up in Massachusetts, and she had traced back our genealogy to and before the Revolutionary War, and pretty much all in the North, no slaveholders, thank God. And so, you know, her request to me before she died, one of her requests to me, this was actually a couple of years before she died, but when she knew that she could no longer do this genealogy work, was to please finish it so that her grandchildren could qualify for DAR, which is what she wanted to be, Daughters of the American Revolution, and SAR, Sons of the American Revolution, because there's some scholarships and stuff associated with that, and she just thought it was cool that, you know, whatever. And so I hired a genealogist two years ago, and it took about a year to track it all down. And sure enough, there it was, and we submitted the application. And now my kids qualify for this, and I've fulfilled my commitment to my mother. But the net of all this is that I have some understanding of this process. My father wouldn't have qualified because his parents came here from Norway. But on my mother's side, you know, it goes all the way back to the 1600s. And one of the things that is just astonishing to me is that, you know, the Sons of the American Revolution, the group that I'm a member of, I mean, they're just basically all about being patriotic Americans. So far, my sense of it is there's not Democrats or Republicans. You know, when I met with these guys, you know, somebody said, "What do you do?" And I said, "You know, I'm the left wing Rush Limbaugh. I do a progressive radio show," and a couple people were like, "Hey, cool." And other people were like, "Well, that should be interesting." You know, I mean, you can tell people's politics, but, you know, nobody was, you know, it's not a political organization. But apparently the Sons of Confederate Veterans are a little more aggressive, shall we say. Interesting story over at Talking Points Memo at TPM. Anyhow, Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yes, I'm surprised that some of the black people in Charleston are so inclusive.
You're talking about like the church service Sunday, they welcomed all the white folks into the church?
Yes, of course. Yes, yeah. Of course. If I or my children were told for a couple of centuries that their brains weren't as large as Europeans, or that they are genetically limited, you know, by authors such as Charles Murray and the Bell Curve,
right,
I would be absolutely furious. I think if people receive these kinds of indignities, they can only be, like, extremely frustrated and angry. I actually applaud them for their spirit. I think the human spirit is amazing, whether it be Jewish people in Germany, or other ethnic groups that have gone through incredible discrimination and tragedy.
Yeah. This happens all around the world. It's the Karen people in Thailand right now being persecuted, for example.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this stuff continues. And I remember a quote that, you know, I love Jefferson, but a quote, where we're reading him a quote, quote by him that he said, the slaves on his plantation worked, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours a day, whatever it was. And he said, I don't really understand these people because at the end of the day, they are, they're still very spirited and, you know, they may sing songs or do whatever. I'm sure it was a survival mechanism for them, for them. But it actually is, their story is an incredible story along with many other groups of the human spirit.
Yeah, and you can go out to Monticello now and you can see where the concentration camp was.
Yes.
Basically.
I visited there a long time ago.
It's called the slave quarters. Yeah.
This is new? They've had it in the past 10 years they've built that? Or
yeah. Yeah, it's we were there last year or the year before, and it was evident that it was new. I mean, all the signs and everything that had to do with the slave quarters looked much more modern than some of the older signage.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's very interesting, yeah.
So yeah, I'm very impressed too by the folks at Mother Emanuel Church and across Charleston that there has not been an explosion of anger, thank God. Obviously a lot of grief, but a call for healing. And I hope that this is a moment in America that could be an extraordinary teaching moment or could just slide into the memory hole. And only time will tell. A lot will, however, have to do with whether or not we continue discussing all of these various things and what we do about it. And what we do about it means at law. And after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, which had passed the Senate by a 99-0 vote, you know, passed the Senate unanimously. One person didn't vote. I think one person was I think it might have been, you know, dead or something, but whatever. But John Roberts still said, well, you know, we no longer have, you know, legal segregation in the United States. And like the president pointed out in Mark Maron's podcast a couple of days ago, you know, it's you don't use the N-word in polite company. And therefore, racism is dead. Well, I'm sorry. Racism is alive and well. It just has taken a more subtle, you know, as Joe Madison says, it's no longer Jim Crow, it's James Crow ESQ. And I would say that this newer, subtler, deeper form of racism is in some ways even more dangerous to the American body politic than the good old boy, obvious kind of, you know, dumb racism. I'm looking for words that I can say on the radio. I'm lacking them. Anyhow, Alan, thank you for the call. I agree with you. Mac in Cowdery, Colorado. Hey, Mac, what's up?
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
First off, I have to tell you that your show matters.
Thank you.
It has had an unmeasurable positive impact on my psyche.
Thank you. So what's on your mind?
Well, about 10 years ago, I got the courage to visit the wall in Washington, D.C.
You mean the Vietnam Veterans, the Vietnam Memorial?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I knew way too many names on it.
Yeah. I walked by
and
that a few months ago, and I couldn't even look for the names that I knew. I was afraid to do it. I just didn't think I could handle it. I'm sorry, Mac. Back to you.
Well, I had the same reaction, but I had to go.
Yeah.
And once I got over the grief and the anger, I looked back at that wall, and it hit me with such clarity. Political rhetoric has consequences.
Yeah, led
often
to that wall.
Rhetoric, it has life and death consequences. And I found a parallel between that wall and those political rhetoric and the political rhetoric that this young man in Charleston heard from all the Republican leaders ever since President Obama has been elected.
Yeah.
I've heard Republican after Republican stand up and say, he's ruining the world. He's driving this country in the ground. It's going in the wrong way. He's taking over.
He's not one of us. He's not a real American. Where's his birth certificate? These are all code for, hey, have you noticed the guy in the White House is black?
Well, yes, I was not surprised. The only thing that surprised me about the Charleston thing is that actually that it wasn't the direct attack against the president.
Yeah. Well, he assassinated a state senator, and he did it in a church that had been started by Vesey, what was his last name? The guy who led the slave rebellion, and I think it was in 1822, and then they hanged him along with a bunch of other folks, and or he didn't lead it. He conspired to lead it. And then they banned black churches until after the Civil War, and they burned that church down. It got rebuilt after the Civil War. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of history in Mother Emanuel Church, and this was an assault on that history as well as on the people in that church.
Yes, and that is so telling of how society actually is.
Yeah.
People don't say the N-word in public anymore. It is so prevalent.
Yeah, but all they have to say is, well, you know, Obama's probably not a real U.S. citizen, or he's not a particularly good president, and, you know, whatever. I mean, it's like Lee Atwater said, you know, we don't have to use the N-word anymore. All we have to do is talk about tax cuts, and everybody gets it that, you know, we're talking about helping out rich people and screwing the poor people, especially the people of color.
Matt, thanks for the call. You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, and Bob Ney is going to drop by with the Talk Radio News Service in about 5 minutes. Stick around. Welcome back. Fred, watching Free Speech TV in Atlanta on the Dish Network. Hey, Fred, what's up? Fred, can you hear me? Fred is on line two, and he can't hear me. Or maybe he just has his phone muted. Bo in Detroit, Michigan. Bo, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. How are you doing, Tom?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good. I really enjoy your show. Well, I always have.
Thank you.
Yeah. Listen, first I want to say I actually went to Michigan State, I think, at the same time you did.
I'm sorry, your voice is kind of muffled, Bo. Could you say that again?
I said I went to Michigan State at the same time you did.
Oh, really? You were at MSU in the 60s, the late 60s?
Well, yeah, well, I actually started in 1970.
Uh-huh. Okay. I was there. I had a summer scholarship when I was 14. That would have been 63, and then I attended for less than one term in 68. So, for what it's worth.
Okay. I thought you were there at the same time.
No.
The exact same time I was.
I think I'm a little older than you are.
I lived in Snyder Phillips.
Yeah, Phillips Hall.
Yeah, Snyder Phillips.
Snyder Phillips. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, what I wanted to say is that, I'm not quite as forgiving as some of my people are about the incidents that have occurred in Charleston and some of the other incidents that I've been involved with. In fact, I've been involved with the Black Liberation Movement for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know, are you familiar with the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, who passed last year?
I don't know him. I don't know that much about him.
Okay, his name was Chukwe Lumumba. Anyway, he was billed as America's most revolutionary mayor. He was on Democracy Now! And a couple other programs.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, anyway. But anyway, I'm just not quite as forgiving. I don't consider myself an American. I consider myself a new African. You know, and to me, American is somebody, I have native Aboriginal people in my family, calling myself an American to me is an insult to them.
Yeah.
Because that means that they get...
Do you, Bo, are you talking kind of in Malcolm X terms? You know, it's time for black people to basically circle the wagon and create their own institutions? Your own institution?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually belong to Malcolm X grassroots movement. Are you familiar with them?
I'm sorry. Your phone is really muffled, Bo. If you could make sure that you don't have a thumb over the microphone or anything. Say that again.
I said, are you familiar with Malcolm X grassroots movement?
Yes.
Okay, I am the regional director in Detroit.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And the guy who I was telling you about, who was the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, actually was the chairman of the national organization.
Okay.
You know, so, yeah, I do think we need to circle the wagons. I think that there's enough. Are you familiar? Would you ever consider having Dr. Francis Kress Welsing on your show?
I'll consider having anybody on the show. Bo, pitch it to Sean Taylor. She's our executive director. Her contact information, I'm pretty sure, is on our website.
Because you talked about these small penis gun owners.
Yeah.
She deals almost directly psychologically with that whole idea.
Yeah, interesting. Bo, thanks a lot for the call. I gotta run here, but thank you for the call. And go Spartans. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Harbin here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, the book that tells how Washington really works, is on the line with us. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today, sir?
Well, we're going to see more of how Washington works once this entire trade bill saga cleans out. But we are awaiting two rulings from the Supreme Court, of course. We don't know what day they'll come, one being the marriage equality, and the other, of course, will be the health care bill.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, we do know the vote of 60-37 on the trade bill, which was a razor-thin, right-on-the-nose vote for procedural motion. Then the trade bill itself will, of course, pass, because it'll need a simple majority now.
You think so? Because I got an email from Lori Wallach this morning. I mean, it was a mass email. It wasn't just personalized to me. I mean, but Public Citizen, you know, and their trade division, that said basically when the American people see what is in TPP, because there will be a 60-day period where we actually get to see what's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that there's going to be so much revulsion and disgust that even though they don't need, even though, it, you know, it can't be filibustered, they don't need 60 votes in the Senate, they only need 50 votes in the Senate, that there's still a very good chance that we can fight this thing the way that we fought SOPA and PIPA and you know, fought for net neutrality. And there's been a number of really surprising and substantial grassroots victories recently.
Oh, I'm not saying by any stretch of imagination that anybody should, you know, lay down on this, but I think the bill is horrible, Tom, personally.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think it's terrible. But right now, Mitch McConnell, I believe, alone with the Republicans, has the votes. It's going to, I agree, though, with her, there are going to be things that are going to be absolutely revolting. And if you look at the polling on this, and if you look at the phone calls, you know, I was told by a couple of staffers it was amazing. And, you know, they would think normally a congressman would react to that and vote against this. So I still think there's always hope for anything. But Mitch McConnell has maneuvered this thing. I mean, he wanted it with a passion. So did John Boehner. And I think I'm safe in saying you're going to see a money trail to this when it comes to John Boehner and Mitch McConnell. I think the president was in it for a different ball game, different reason, although, you know, I wouldn't be happy, you know, with why he's supporting this. But I think that they'll continue on to do anything humanly possible. But again, I think she's correct. And, you know, nobody should lay down on this that's against it. But it's just amazing that it made it razor thin right on the nose.
Yeah. I don't find it quite so amazing, because there's literally trillions of dollars at stake here, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits, and it's fairly cheap to buy members of Congress. I mean, $100,000, $200,000, you know, that's big money in Washington, D.C., even still these days. And, you know, if you've got a couple of billion dollars on the line, buying a couple of hundred members of Congress doesn't seem like a big, sure, big lift, frankly.
When I say amazing, in the past, these trade bills had wider margins, But this one, I think, people finally have woken up so much around the country, and even on the Republican citizen side,
yeah,
the average citizen is just absolutely appalled by this piece of legislation.
Well, they've got Drudge, and they've got Mark Levin. I mean, there's a couple of right-wing sites, and the Obamatrade.com website that Curtis Ellis put together is brilliant. And they're all from a totally right-wing perspective.
Right. And, of course, Ted Cruz is against it now because he just can't stand anything that President Obama wants, which, you know, Cruz is finished. I hate to even mention his name in the process. I did want to mention the flag debate. Tom, have you carried any of the story about Earl Holt by chance?
No. I don't know who Earl Holt is.
The site, and I've got to look down at my notes here, but the site would be crooksandliars.com.
Oh, is right? Earl Holt the Conservative Citizens Council guy who was given money, $57,000, as I recall, to the various Republican candidates?
That's it. And you've got Mitt Romney, Rob Portman of Ohio, Ron Johnson, Sharon Angle, Ken Buck. I mean, it goes on and on. You've got also Rick Santorum. And the reason I mention this story is because now – not only in the Carolinas has the flag debate taken a complete different turn, but now Mississippi, the Speaker of the House, who's now had an enlightenment that it's time to remove the flag. And I mention this because with this man's money, Earl Holt, and if you would see his quotes, which I really wouldn't want to read on your show, but if you go to crooksandliars.com, his quotes are just horrible, and not only about African Americans, but about Jewish people. But he has passed out money and around. So I think on the Republican side, you know, how they say there's going to be some explaining to do. I think on their side, how they ever got wrapped up with the guy, people turn bad. I understand it.
This is the Southern strategy, Bob. Nixon came up with this idea that, you know, the Strom Thurmond had gone off and started the Dixiecrats back in the late 50s, you know, in response to Brown v. Board, and they were Democratic white racists. And Richard Nixon said, if I'm going to win, I need to get those Democratic white racists. And he created the Southern Strategy. And then Reagan put it on steroids after his first speech after the Republican nominating convention. His first speech as an official candidate for president of the United States was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is the town where Cheney and Schwerner and Goodman were murdered, the three civil rights actors, activists, excuse me. And he gave a speech on states' rights. I mean, you know, racism has been like in the South in particular, has been like one of the major ways that the Republican Party has been able to win victories.
Well, this spread across, and you've even got, you know, like I said, Rick Santorum, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul.
Yeah.
And I mention this because it's becoming the, you know, celebrity cause of the day on the flag. And I'm not trying to say we're reporting that's a bad thing. But you look at the amount of money that came from this man of, you know, $65,000+, and the fact that people were brazen enough to take it. I think there are people going to be doing a lot of reverse positions very, very fast.
Yeah. The question is, will they stop the talking in code stuff? You know, is Obama really a citizen, et cetera, all this other stuff. Bob Ney, author of Sideswipe for the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm very pleased and honored to have Sam Daly Harris, founder of Results, the CEO of the Center for Citizen Empowerment and Transformation, the author of an extraordinary book, Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government, with a foreword by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Muhammad Yunus, and a new chapter on the Citizens Climate Lobby. Great stuff, Sam.
Great, thanks.
It's great having you with us, as always. The revolution is underway. Let's talk about citizen activism. You work with a lot of groups.
Well, let me just say the messages from the book are, number one, most people are cynical and hopeless about making a difference with their voices as citizens, sad to say. Number two, over the last 35 years, I've seen people make a profound difference. Mm-hmm. Number three, which is the tough one, You got to find an organization that offers you more than mouse clicks. You've got to find an organization that offers a structure of support whereby you're in groups and you have maybe a monthly conference call, guest speakers, and you get to go from kindergarten, third, fifth, ninth, 12th grade and beyond as an activist.
You know, and there's such a broad spectrum of them. I mean, at the kind of base of the pyramid, as it were, there's things like drinking liberally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's chapters all over the country. Mm-hmm. People just get together, you know, at a bar, and then they got screening liberally in New York and some of the larger cities where they get together. And then you go to things like Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, or MoveToAmend.org, which now has 500 chapters around the country.
Right.
People starting literally starting chapters in their kitchens, you know, just say, okay, I can do this. Tell us about some of the groups that you know.
Yeah, so for example, I'm in town this particular week because Citizens Climate Lobby is having their annual conference.
Mm-hmm.
6 years ago, they had 25 people here. Today, they've got 800 here.
Wow.
And the difference is they're not just on the Hill today and they go home and they'll be back in a year. No, they go home and they'll be back in their congressman's office in August or October or February or April or whatever.
The local offices.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's not a one and done kind of thing. It's an ongoing kind of growth. Last year, their volunteers in the U.S. and Canada had 2,253 letters to the editor published, up from 36 in 2010. Something's going on there, and the something is grassroots empowerment. And so you need to link with a group like them, citizensclimatelobby.org or results.org on global and domestic poverty or peacealliance.org on peace issues if you want more than the mouse clicks.
Yeah. One of the things that I was noticing and talking about back in 2010 when the Tea Party started, well, really 2009 when the Tea Party started emerging, initially I think as a backlash to the first black president being elected, and largely, and then secondarily a backlash to a Democrat being elected. Oh my God! Mm-hmm. And then we watched the Tea Party basically be taken over by shills for the Koch brothers, you know, where $300,000 brand new spiffy fancy painted buses were bringing Tea Partiers into Washington D.C. to quote hold rallies and things, and it's kind of degenerated and fallen apart since then. But there was this strain that ran through it, setting aside the racist strain and setting aside the corporatist shills and manipulators. There were a lot of people of good heart and good faith, maybe misguided, they've been watching Fox News too long, who showed up because our government is not working. You know, it's been ever since the Powell memo, Lewis Powell was successful. He started that in 76 when he wrote the Buckley case, and basically the corporations have taken over to a large extent. And it looked to me like this is populism. And I'm seeing it on the right? And I'm seeing this incredible populist movement. And I started wondering, you know, where's the populist movement on the left? Where's it, you know, when's it going to happen? Because I was part of one in the 60s. I was in SDS. And it was very much it was a student movement, but it was also a populist movement. It was a grassroots movement. And now I'm seeing that happening around Bernie Sanders. I'm seeing that happen around a lot of these groups that you're talking about. It seems to me that we're at one of those moments in the history of our country. And I think they happen at probably every other generation or maybe every third generation where there's actually a craving, a longing for, I want to participate, I want to be part of something, I want to do something more than just vote, more than just complain.
I saw your interview with Hedrick Smith a couple of weeks ago where he talks about, don't look here in Washington for the change. Look at what's going on out in communities.
Yeah.
On Move to Amend, on the hourly wage, et cetera, et cetera. So, but when people do get together and they do connect with others, there's got to be some there for them to, like, grow. I was speaking last year at an elite university in the United States, and I had the honor of meeting a professor of organizing, genius guy, and I talked for 20 minutes about the work, and he said, why do you do it that way, and how does this work? And then he looks at me and says, yeah, but Congress is really dysfunctional. I said, yeah, Congress is really dysfunctional. And last year it appropriated $1.65 billion for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Congress is really dysfunctional. Last year appropriated $715 million from maternal and child health programs around the world. Congress is really dysfunctional, but if you roll up your sleeves, do your homework, and get in there, you can make some big things happen. So right. People need to know that even people of stature see the whole thing as a mess and dysfunctional, and yet we need to engage but get some support if we do.
So rules for the road. You want to start a group, you're joining a group, you want to have the maximum impact with, with your life.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, the bottom line is you might be group shopping. Uh-huh. And the shopping is, where's a group that feeds me?
Right.
You know, that I go there and I walk in 1 foot tall and I kind of walk out after a few months 3 feet, 5 feet tall kind of thing. They're really feeding me with information, and more than information, with empowerment. I mean, a group like the Peace Alliance would be working on the Youth Promise Act, funding poverty prevention, violence prevention programs around the U.S. They'll have a monthly conference call. Maybe Bobby Scott, the congressman from North Carolina, who introduced it, is a guest kind of thing.
Right.
And Results might be working on global poverty, and they'll have Paul Farmer from Partners in Health as a guest speaker one of the months. So you're kind of in this like ongoing education piece that takes you to another level.
Bernie Sanders once suggested, actually many times on this program, he's been on every Friday for 10 years now, that what you should do is find a hall, like, you know, rent the school gymnasium or whatever you can get, you know, find a hall that you can get cheap or for free, rent it or, you know, book it, and then go to your member of the House of Representatives and say, we're going to have a town hall, we're putting up posters all over the town, and we're advertising that you're going to be there.
Okay, that's one way to go.
And then out of that, the people who put that thing together become the local activist group. Yeah. You know, I mean, this is like, there's so many ways to start this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I just need to get going. And there's this quote from Apollo astronaut Rusty Schweikert who said, we aren't passengers on spaceship Earth. We're the crew.
Yeah.
We aren't residents on this planet. We're citizens.
Right.
The difference in both cases is responsibility. And write in the book, in the mid-80s, when we were really kind of beginning to feel our oats and results, we would walk up to the cockpit and notice there's nobody up there.
Yeah.
And that we need to do our homework so we can give instructions to get this thing on the right course.
Yeah, to kind of flip Pogo on his head, we have seen the future, the potential, the opportunity. Yeah. And it is us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, at the CCL conference yesterday, the founder said, you know, I used to thought like the big shots were going to handle the important stuff.
No.
Everyone in that room is clear. They're not.
It's the volunteers.
Exactly. But then we need to then do our homework and get with an organization that can help us do our homework.
There you go. Sam Daly Harris, his book, Reclaiming Our Democracy. And the website is citizenempowermentandtransformation.org. Thank you, Sam.
Great. Thanks so much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
citizenempowermentandtransformation.org. Check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Fred in Atlanta, Georgia. It almost looks, from what I see on the screen here, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network, that you want to echo what Sam was just saying.
I haven't been paying real close attention. I was actually sort of, my blood boiled when the man called an hour or so ago saying Arabs don't have a right to live in Israel.
Right.
Like, and that got me thinking about stuff I've wanted to talk with you about for a while. I agree with you on most things, Tom, but sometimes I hear so much Americanism, and I think, yeah, we are riding the globe. And now I remember a little about what Tim was saying earlier, that, you know, we're all in this thing together. And when we draw lines, whether it's the 49th parallel, it's artificial stuff. And I think we really need to, like PPP, I want workers everywhere to benefit, not just American workers.
Right. Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm of the opinion, and feel free to contradict me or argue with me about it if you want, But I'm of the opinion that in the United States, our first priority should be American workers. In Mexico, their first priority should be Mexican workers. In Costa Rica, their first priority should be Costa Rican workers. And this globalism makes the first priority none of the workers, but instead the global elites.
Well, and that's the effect that it has.
Right.
The problem is that when the elites can separate the global workers, then we can sort of fight with at the worker level, competing viciously, and the benefits go to those people who set us up.
Right, and that's my problem with these trade deals. You know, we used to have a trade policy that was America first, and we no longer do, and we no longer make things in this country. We don't make the things that are critical to us on so many different levels. We invent them here, but we don't make them here. And increasingly, we're not even inventing them.
Yeah, well, and certainly we're having issues in that sense. But then when these deals come along, the way they are structured is so that corporations, the elite, if you will, can go to Vietnam and pay a worker 65 cents an hour.
Right.
Instead of paying that worker a living, decent wage. And in fact, I would like, and this is, I'm a little bit weird, I guess, but I would like to see the Vietnamese manufacturing cars and the South Americans manufacturing stuff for themselves, because I think that with some of the trade makes for inefficiency. How much energy is wasted transporting stuff? I saw
this is how bizarre it's gotten. Fred, I totally agree with you. This is how bizarre it's gotten. Chicken producers in the United States, chicken farmers, are taking chickens. They slaughter them, but they don't pluck them. They put them on a boat and ship them to China, where Chinese labor then plucks the chickens, de-skins them, does whatever you do to chickens, and then ships them back here wrapped in plastic, you know, ready for the meat store, you know, for the meat counter in the store. And it's like,
yes.
Can you imagine the amount of diesel fuel that is shipping that chicken all the way to China? I mean, it's 6,000 miles away and back.
Tom, chickens are light. I saw this old house showed years ago where they took few radiators out of a house in Massachusetts and crushed it or whatever, put it on a boat, shipped it to Japan where they made a car to send back to the U.S.
Right, exactly. When Reagan came into office, we were the major importer of raw material and exporter of finished goods in the world. We are now the major exporter of raw materials, wood and coal mostly, and importer of finished goods in the world. It's wrong. Fred, thank you. Five minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Gary in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Gary, you had a question about Fast Track, the TPA?
Yes. Tom, you first of all, I want to say you've given me great inspiration. I've been calling the senators as well as the representatives earlier when we needed to call the representatives. I called all the senators yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Good on you.
Pardon me?
I said good on you.
What I want to know and clearly understand is what exactly happened. You mentioned there was some type of a filibuster or something that the
yes.
Democrats did that sounded like it turned out now they needed fewer votes to pass.
No, here's how it works. When something goes through the Senate, first, it has to come to the floor of the Senate, and there's a vote to consider or something like this, a vote to open the debate. And if somebody objects to that, that's called a filibuster, and they can say, I object. And to overcome that objection, instead of, so there's 100 people in the Senate, instead of 50 votes, which is what you know, majority rules, you need 60 votes to overcome that filibuster. So they got the 60 votes. And they had the debate. And then when the debate is done, then they have to have a motion to, I think it's reconsider or close debate, end debate, a motion to end debate. And the motion to end debate some Democrat, I don't know who it was, said, no, I don't want to end the debate on this. And, you know, let's just leave it going forever. Let's not have a vote. And so because of that objection by a Democrat, there was, or more than one, probably, they had to have 60 votes to overcome that. They got the 60 votes. Now, the final vote is just going to be a vote, and you can't filibuster the vote. You can only filibuster the debate. And so the vote will be held tomorrow, and they only need 50 votes to make it happen. Am I making sense? The Senate processes are weird and Byzantine, but this is like kind of how it works.
So they need 50 or 51% to approve it.
Well, they'll need... If they really only need 50 votes, because if they had 50 votes for and 50 votes against, Joe Biden would be the one who breaks the tie, and he represents Barack Obama, okay. President Obama, who is in favor of this. So they really only need 50 okay. votes.
Well, I appreciate the clarification, and you have truly been an inspiration. I called the 28th District here in Tacoma, and I'm going to start going to their meetings. I want to see both Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, somebody go up against them. I totally support the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I don't support the corporatists. And I believe if you don't support, I think it was Franklin Roosevelt and also Teddy Roosevelt both said that if people don't make a living wage, they're basically slaves.
Yes, Teddy Roosevelt called it the Square Deal. Franklin Roosevelt called it the New Deal. But it was all about you should not, if you're working, in Teddy Roosevelt's case, it was a 50-hour work week. In Franklin's, it was 40. If you're working a 40-hour or 50-hour work week, you should not be living in poverty. You should be able to raise a family. And we've played on the air here numerous times Teddy Roosevelt's comments on that and Franklin's. I won't redo that now. But, yeah, I'm with you. By the way, Shano just said you're our caller of the day to receive a free copy of one of my books. Would you like a book, Gary?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let me put you on hold. Danielle, Gary is on line 8, and you can get his, you can figure out which book he wants, and you can get his address information. Shirley in Farwell, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Shirley, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. I come to a conclusion of what the corporations have become.
Okay.
They have become just like parasites. A parasite will live on off a host, don't care if the host lives or dies. And they have not only done it in our country, when they went to Mexico, is Mexico better off now? No.
Right.
What are they doing to China? They're exploiting China. So that's what I've come to the conclusion. Many of the rich, they've all become parasites, living off of us or whoever they can live off of, giving nothing and taking everything. And in the end, what happens to a parasite when they kill the host?
Well, they either have to find a new host or they die.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, even they're even willing to destroy the whole world. So, you know, I don't know what you feel about that. I am angry right now. I am so angry. I'm having a difficult time keeping it under,
yeah.
You know.
Well, Shirley, let me add some nuance to what you're saying. I agree with you, first of all. But I would say that it's not corporations and rich people. It is the structure of unregulated and deregulated capitalism, which started in the 1980s with Reaganism. It is this deregulated capitalism that makes it possible for very wealthy people or for big corporations to become parasites. Prior to the 80s, we had rich people and we had big corporations, but they were not parasites. They were symbiotes. A symbiote is something that lives in us that it has a symbiotic relationship with us. In other words, we help each other. We've got bacteria in our gut, for example, that actually, you know, oh, my God, there's bacteria in my gut. No, it's supposed to be there. It helps digest your food. So our food provides a little bit of nutrition to the bacteria. The bacteria, in turn, breaks down the food so that we can more readily absorb it through our intestines. That's a symbiotic relationship. And we used to have a symbiotic relationship with our corporations. Biggest employer in the United States, you know, when I was a kid, was General Motors. And they were paying, in today's dollars, $54 an hour on average. Now the biggest employer, and that's a symbiotic relationship. The workers were doing well, and General Motors was doing well. Now the biggest employer in the United States is Walmart, and they pay their workers on average around $9 an hour, that's a parasitic relationship. I agree with you. So I would say that the reason that the parasites have risen up, or the symbiotes have become parasites, is because Reaganism changed the rules of business in the United States. And that's why it's so important that we repeal not just the Reagan tax cuts, but all, you know, all this whole trickle-down economics thing. Blow it out. Shirley,
you're
thank
listening
you for the call.
To the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with more of your calls right after the news at the bottom of the hour. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Lenny, listening on 880 AM in Oakland, California. Hey, Lenny, what's up?
Hi. Tom, I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a suggestion that I would like to get your opinion on.
Okay.
I would like to tie a huge infrastructure bill to the TPP, okay, and have the Democrats say that they will support TPP if we pass this huge job-creating infrastructure bill. And I think those two would kind of work together.
I agree with you. Here's the problem. The way that you do that through the legislative process is by what's called an amendment. In other words, you would amend an infrastructure bill to the TPP so that they have to pass, if it passes, it all passes at once, right? And with Fast Track, which was just, the filibuster was just broken in the Senate, and the vote's going to be held tomorrow, and they only need 50 votes, so the Republicans are going to push this thing through. With Fast Track, now it is illegal. The members of Congress cannot amend any trade deals that are considered under the rules of Fast Track. And so what you just proposed, in all, today we got a step closer, tomorrow in all probability will certainly be impossible.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I had,
it's really good. It's a really great idea, though, Lenny.
And I sent an email over to Pelosi on it. I guess I'm a little bit late. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's a brilliant idea, and it's one of the reasons why Fast Track is so pernicious, is so cancerous, because it prevents amendments to legislation, and so you can't improve the bill, you can't modify the bill, you can't change a single word in it. It comes from the 600 corporate lawyers, and gets dropped on the floor of Congress, and they either vote for it or they vote against it, period. They cannot change a single word. And so, you know, we'll see where this goes, Lenny, but you're on to something. It's just unfortunate that you know, they saw you coming, and that's why the whole Fast Track thing, that's why Richard Nixon came up with Fast Track in the first place back when he was shilling for Pepsi-Cola and came up with the first Fast Track. Thanks a lot for the call. Andrew in Noakesville, Virginia. Hey, Andrew. You say, I am responsible for the rise of racism in America?
But here's the thing. I don't like living in an echo chamber. I am a moderately conservative person. I was raised by Democrats. And so I always make sure I spend some time watching MSNBC, listening to progressive radio. There's nothing learned when you're just talking to people who are as common thought.
What's your point, Andrew?
My concern is people like you who take disagreements with the president and turn it into and claim it to be racism, or disagreement in policy, tax policy.
Do you think shouting "you," a white Southern congressman shouting "you lie" at the first black African, African-American president in the history of our country during a State of the Union address, something that has never been done in the history of this country, does not have some racial tinge to it? Do you think that white politicians saying "we don't know if this guy is really an American" don't have racial overtones?
There are a lot of things that people have said and done that you can point to individuals. First of all, the gentleman who said that actually was born out to be true.
No, it wasn't.
And no, he was. But I'm not here to discredit policy with you, because we can go around and around and around, and eventually you'll cut me off and then go into a monologue how you beat me on the conversation. But what I'm saying is, when when somebody says, I disagree with the president, and he's white, and you say, you're a racist.
And Andrew, you apparently don't listen to this program enough to know how I respond. Because if somebody disagrees with the president, and yes, I am going to cut you off. If somebody disagrees with the president, I'm not going to call him a racist for that. That's stupid. And, you know, I have some pride in my intellect. I don't think I'm that dumb. Robert in Greenville, North Carolina. He, in fact, it's rather insulting to be to have it being suggested that I'm that dumb. Robert in Greenville, North Carolina. Hey, Robert, you wanted to talk about the conservative flag or the Confederate flag? I guess it's the conservative flag too. Well, it's the Conservative Citizens Council.
Right. Well, the only reason Governor Nikki Haley and Senator Scott and Graham changed their view on taking the Confederate battle flag down was pressure from Rance Priebus and Sharon Day, the leaders of the RNC, because the problems it's causing their candidates running for president.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, all the news media is making Governor Haley into a political star for doing the right thing, and she was told to do it. It wasn't because of her heart. It's all, you know, Earl Holt, the leader of the Council of Conservative Citizens, who is cited by the shooter, Dylan Roof,
right,
made $65,000 in donations to Republicans. Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, Iowa Rep. Steve King, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake,
Michelle Bachmann,
Mitt Romney's 2012 run for president, former
right,
Minnesota Rep. Michelle Bachmann. And then you have Haley Barbert on Morning Joe today saying he wasn't offended by the Confederate flag. This is the same racist governor who reminds me of Boss Hogg, who said we never had problems with the Klan when I was growing up because the Citizens Council took care of anyone that could get out of line. The all-white Citizens Council was the South's answer to desegregation. Their motto, we are proud of our white blood and our white heritage.
Right.
We are against mongrelizers. Now the Citizens Council is called the Council of Conservative Citizens, and there we will not be integrated.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, this is, it's insanity. And people are make it look like all of a sudden the Republicans are now, you know, changing. It's all a game. They're just playing a game because it's so close to the presidential election.
Yeah. That's the bad news, Robert. The good news is that political pressure actually had some effect. You know, yeah, the party leaders, I think the cascade really began when Mitt Romney tweeted out, it's time to take down the flag. You know, he's viewed as, by Republicans, as a serious, solid, relatively independent, moderate voice. And at that point, I think it became almost impossible for any of the serious Republican candidates for president. And by serious, I mean people other than Donald Trump and Mike Huckabee and, you know, the hustlers who are in there to continue to hold to those positions. And you know, Mike Huckabee is still not holding to that position. And I, God only knows what Donald Trump is thinking. But so, you know, on the one hand, yeah, it was a cynical political move. And they're not going to change the Southern strategy. They're not going to stop calling out by dog whistle to white people, white racists. But on the other hand, there was enough public pressure that something changed. And isn't that a good thing, Robert?
Yeah, well, it was the poll said it was 49% against and 49% for. So I mean, I guess we're divided down the middle.
Yeah.
It's the North and South, you know, kind of divided down the middle again.
Yeah.
And Chuck Todd on Meet the Press this past weekend, they were talking about Bernie Sanders, you know, and the crowds he was getting. And but he said something that Ralph Nader at one time had a crowd of over 15,000 when he was running.
Right.
And he said, and he only wound up getting like 2.5% of the vote in the election. So he was basically saying, don't get too excited. Everybody might be getting excited over Bernie, but when it comes right down to it, are you going to vote for Bernie or vote for Hillary?
Right.
But I think this is a different time than when Ralph Nader ran.
Well, and not only that, Bernie's not running as an independent or on a green
right,
ticket. Bernie's running as a Democrat, and the Democrats don't get 2% of the vote. You know,
I honestly think Bernie has a chance.
I do, too.
If
I really do.
I think he has a chance to go all the way and be president of the United States.
I do, too. And I think he's the only one that deserves to be the president of the United States right now that's running.
I agree.
Anyway, yeah. I'm frustrated. Like the last call you had, I don't know how you do it.
Oh,
I swear to God, I don't know how you talk to these people over and over.
Yeah.
I can't take it anymore.
Well, that's
old, I guess, for that.
Yeah, that's it's part of my job description, Robert. So, but thank you very much for the call. A very thoughtful call, and I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Sandy in Des Moines, Iowa, watching us on live stream. Sandy, we got a minute to the break. It's all yours. Sandy? No, Sandy. Okay, let's try Karen, listening on WCPT in Chicago.
Oh, hi. This is Karen. I'm from DuPage County, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to tell you that the progressives have taken over the Democratic Party, building by precinct and getting precinct captains. It's been going on for about 6 years, and one of the issues we're having is the old guard, who have now aligned themselves with the Republicans and are trying to drain us of money. And I wondered if you had any suggestions for how to go forward so that they aren't interrupting the 2016 election like they did in 2014.
I missed a word there, Karen. Who has aligned themselves with the Republicans?
The people who were previously in charge of the party, who did not get any, they have very few.
Oh, interesting.
So the old
guard Democrats are working against the progressives who are taking over the party. Gee, without knowing more detail, I don't know how to advise you other than just keep moving forward, keep bringing progressives in, keep running for getting people to run for precinct committee chairmen. And keep taking over the party. It's great what you're doing. Karen, keep it up. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. Welcome back. And let's see here. James, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Oak Harbor, Washington. You wanted to disagree with me and say, God bless Robert E. Lee? Really? James? Either James is muted or he's on line 7. I don't know. We'll see where that goes. Let's try Sandy in Des Moines, Iowa, watching on live stream. Sandy, can you hear me?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Sandy. What's up?
Your guest earlier mentioned Citizens Climate Lobby.
Right.
And I've been to some of their events and presentations, even one with James Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
And I really object to their support of nuclear power. And that it really bothers me that an environmental group is supporting nuclear power.
Does the Citizens Climate Lobby support nuclear power, or have they just had some speakers like James Hansen who support nuclear power?
I believe, their presentation was in favor of nuclear power.
Yeah.
And
that surprises me.
Yeah, me too. I did, and it upsets me.
Yeah.
And Hansen even said that nuclear power was safer than solar power, which I could believe he said.
Yeah. Well, Hansen is pretty hysterical right now. I mean, he thinks that we're very, very close to irreversible tipping points. And,
mm-hmm.
And so I think he's thinking that, nuclear power is better than, anything is better than fossil fuels. What he fails to understand, I believe, and or I'm wrong on it. I mean, he's the scientist. I'm just a talk show host. But what I think he fails to understand is how much fossil fuel goes into a nuclear power plant. You've got to build the thing. You've got to make an enormous amount of concrete, which is a very carbon dioxide intensive producing process. You got to make a lot of steel, which takes a lot of energy, which is provided by fossil fuels. And then when you fuel the things with, enriched uranium, you've got to mine that uranium out of the ground. You use fossil fuels to do that. You've got to transport it to a place to refine it, which takes fossil fuels. It has to be refined by centrifuge, which takes electricity generated by fossil fuels. And then, you've got to figure out a way to store it afterwards, and that's probably going to take fossil fuels. So there's an enormous amount of fossil fuel input into nuclear power. what was her name? Helen Caldicott was on this program, and she said that the average nuclear power plant does not start producing carbon-free electricity until, as I recall, its ninth or tenth year in operation. And so, you know, solar power, wind power, yes, you need fossil fuels to make them as well because they, you know, they require technology, right? But yeah. They're much less technology intensive. They're much more, you know, they're being mass produced now in very simple ways, and they don't produce waste that is toxic for a million years. So I can't speak to the Citizens Climate Lobby. I don't know that much about them, and our guest who does is no longer here, so I can't ask. But, you know, I've had James Hansen on this program, and I disagree with him about nuclear power, but that doesn't mean that the other things he says are not brilliant and that I shouldn't allow him to make a presentation on my program. So it may well be that that's the way that they were thinking. I just don't know. Sandy, thanks for the call. I'll have to look into it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media, your media support group for We the People. And Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great.
There's one thing that's been really bothering me about this whole TPP fiasco in the making, and that is why this is considered an agreement and not a treaty. I mean, it seems like such an important thing for the whole world. If it were a treaty, it would need 66 votes
in the Senate.
Senate, two-thirds.
That's correct.
Right. And who is the brilliant guy who changed the wording and made it into an agreement rather than a treaty?
Richard Nixon.
How does that work?
Richard Nixon did. I wrote a piece about it for Alternet, which I don't know if it's up on Alternet now or not, but you might be able to find it. Richard Nixon came up with this idea that and he was doing it as a shill for Pepsi at the time. When he was vice president in 1959, he started shilling for Pepsi. He ended up as president going to China to shill for Pepsi. In 59, he went to Russia or the Soviet Union to shill for Pepsi. We don't know if he was being bribed under the table the way the Milk Producer Association gave him $500,000 in cash, just brought it into the Oval Office and handed it to him to get him to raise milk price supports. But whether he was bribed or whether it was just, you know, he just loved Pepsi. In fact, he was in Dallas the day before JFK was assassinated with the president of Pepsi. And there are some, you know, conspiracy theorists who think he was there to set up the Kennedy killing. No, he was there to set up the killing of the American middle class. So Nixon knew that giving most favored nation status to China would be a very difficult thing to do. So he came up with this thing called Fast Track, where it's like, okay, we're going to negotiate a trade agreement. It's not going to be a treaty because it's going to be limited to business between corporations and corporations, and the government isn't going to be all that involved in it other than just setting the rules for it. There's a whole rationale for it. I believe they are treaties and that they should require, you know, the Constitution says treaties are negotiated by the president and require a two-third vote of the Senate. I believe that these have all been treaties. The NAFTA was a treaty. The Colombia Free Trade Agreement was a treaty. The Peru Free Trade Agreement was a treaty. The South Korean Free Trade but none of them were pushed through as treaties. In every single case, they were pushed through as, quote, trade agreements, which only require a majority vote in the House and the Senate. And I think
that's like on the same level as like saying giving Congress, Congress has the power to declare war. But yet we've had all these wars since the last.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Vietnam was a conflict, not a war. Therefore, it didn't.
It was not a war.
Yeah.
So is this by executive order?
No, all of Congress was complicit in it. It was basically the Republican Party's efforts to satisfy the Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. So one other point, Tom, that I think I called a couple weeks ago, but I didn't get on. In terms of these mergers and acquisitions you were talking about a couple weeks ago,
yeah,
and where all this money is coming from, this vast pool of money,
right.
Well, I think all you got to do is look at the policy of the Fed with the quantitative easing
and all that zero interest money.
You're exactly right, Mark. These mergers and acquisitions are being funded with low cost debt, and that's the problem, because these companies are just taking on enormous amounts of debt. The executives are walking off with hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in many cases. They're making out like bandits. The stockholders are doing well because the value of the stock goes up, as the particularly with the stock buybacks, but the mergers also. But workers are losing their jobs as a consequence of it. And when the Fed starts raising interest rates, and it's not an if, it's a when the Fed starts raising interest rates, these companies are going to have a hard time servicing that debt. And you're going to start seeing a wave of disintegrations, bankruptcies, companies spinning pieces off, you know, consolidating all the debt into one company and taking, you know, the good companies off of that and then letting that one company go down. I mean, we've seen this before. This is cyclical. We've seen this happen before. And that's how it's going to play out. And it'll probably provoke a crash. It'll probably provoke a real disaster. And it's one of the reasons why the whole world holds its breath every time the Fed meets, you know, in fear that they might even raise interest rates, you know, at 10th of a point. You know, it's just because this could be the beginning of the end of the cheap mergers and acquisitions. But the debt is still around. We're addicted to debt. Mark, thank you for the call. Tosh in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Tosh, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my phone call. I just wanted to say this treachery act, treason that the South has been doing for a long time, and we've never called it. The United States is scared of it. We've never dealt with the issue. And we continue to just kick the can down the road. And secondly, I mean, when we defeated Germany on the Nazis, did we allow them to keep their flag up over Germany?
No.
Absolutely not.
Right.
We did not. And there's no reason for it. And that symbolizes the divide, the hurt, and all these other agony things that came along with that Civil War.
Yeah. Here's the difference, Tosh, between what happened in Germany and in Japan and what happened in the United States of the Civil War. In Germany and Japan, you had death cults, and they were cults. The Hitlerism was a cult. Tojoism was a cult. And emperor worship was a cult. And you had these death cults where, you know, the Japanese soldiers or pilots would fly right into the decks of American ships. You had the Nazis, you know, with ethnic cleansing and all this stuff. After the war, in both Germany and Japan, the people woke up from the trance of the cult, right? They got decultified, deprogrammed. In the South, the white Southern slaveholders and those who benefited from slavery, they lost the war, but they never got deprogrammed. Today, to this day, the mentality of slavery continues to live in the South. Paul Krugman did a brilliant piece about this in the New York Times yesterday. And he didn't use the language that I'm using, but if you read his piece, you will get it, that he's saying the same thing. That in the South, that's where you find the right to work for less. That's where you find the antipathy toward unions. That's where you find that they don't want to raise the minimum wage. That's where you find they don't want to help poor people out by expanding Medicare. Why? Because they still have this mentality of at least the white middle class and upper middle class power structure in the South still has that plantation / concentration camp mentality. And that's what's going on. And we need to deprogram the South. They need to go through the same. Thank you, Tosh, for the call. They need to go through that same awakening that the average German did after World War II when they said, holy cow, our government was nuts and so were we. Or the average Japanese after World War II. Holy cow, our government was nuts and so were we. People in the South have not yet come. White people in the South have not yet come to that realization. I think we're moving in that direction, though. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.